Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Petrina Law in this episode. Petrina is head of OpenLearn with the UK Open University. Petrina has a fantastic insight into open learners and open learning and their differentiation from MOOCs. Petrina and I talked in the Jenny Lee Building at the Open University's Milton Keynes campus.
Well, it's my privilege to be talking with Dr. Petrina Law, who is the head of OpenLearn at the Open University. Petrina, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Can we get started then with just a brief overview of your career and publications to date?
Yes, I've worked in higher education for 17 years, ostensibly at the Open University. My background is in online learning. VLE development was my first project at the Open University, and I moved into the evaluation of new course material that was being delivered to our students. And then I moved into OER. My background is in science, and I have a master's degree in public understanding of science as well. So I really was interested in communication and science communication initially. But OER, Open Educational Resources, really piqued my interest. And I was given an opportunity to work on some large externally funded projects with the Hewlett Foundation and the Gates Foundation for delivery of open educational resources through the US, and then evaluating those projects. The interesting thing to me at that time was that the Open University was delivering its own open educational resources through the Open Learn platform and through its third-party channels on iTunes, YouTube. And no one really knew who these learners were or why they were taking the OER for themselves, their motivations, their demographics. So I decided then to turn my research lens, onto these learners. And this is research that I have done in my spare time. And my publications are around the impact of OER on this group, particularly the Open Learn population, of which there are now almost 8 million learners a year. And they have revealed many interesting things that relate not just to the OER world, but to online learning generally, I would say.
So your interest in open education went way back to, what, the start of the millennium?
No, my interest in open education actually was only really from about 2011, 2012, when I became involved in these large externally funded projects. I knew about it because working in the Institute for Educational Technology, there were people already working in that field and I was aware of their projects. But I was mostly looking at formal taught learning at the time and the use of our own internal VLE. And that VLE is used in a form for the delivery of open content on OpenLearn. So I had that sort of bridge there. But I found it intriguing and beguiling because there was, at the time that I started researching learners, a lot of theory about the business benefits of open educational resources and lots of theory about what people were using OER for, and very little on asking individuals at scale what they were doing with it. There are a lot of case studies, most of them in America, but very few that looked at scale. And we have at the Open University a massive platform that's delivering to scale. So it was a golden opportunity. I felt that it was a gold mine, literally, of data waiting to be tapped. And there we have done many things with the data. And I would say those key things are to really make it shine as a business endeavour. It does outreach very, very well. Mm. But really to turn that into something that's impactful to the business has been incredibly satisfying. And I've managed to achieve that through my research.
So your involvement with OER actually predates MOOCs, doesn't it?
Yes, it does a little. I was sort of on the cusp there because when I took my role in the Open Media Unit to start working on OpenLearn formally, as opposed to someone dealing with it from a distance, MOOCs, or the Open University's investment in MOOCs through FutureLearn, happened at the same time. It was a big impact to the university. There were millions of pounds being put into the FutureLearn endeavour, and an absolute fraction of that being put into open educational resources. And what was the difference between the two things? You know, they were two different platforms, one shinier than the other at the time, one with a really big press effort behind it. And I can see the reasons why the FutureLearn platform was set up. I do understand that there was a need for a British endeavour in that regard. And there was obviously work going on in the States with Coursera and others. And the two things intrigued me. There was a lot of research that took place on courses that had been delivered for FutureLearn that I was involved in, and those same courses that were being delivered on OpenLearn as OER. The difference there being where a course is delivered as a MOOC, it had at the time support of tutors. The idea was all about social learning and everyone working together. Whereas a course on OpenLearn is completely unsupported and you can start and finish at your own time, at your own pace. So we were able to deliver the same surveys to those groups of people, do the same research, find out who they were, look at their completion rates and their satisfaction. And some very interesting things were pulled from those comparisons that showed us that, sort of quite bluntly, the demographic was very different. FutureLearn was meeting a very well-educated group. OpenLearn was meeting a less educated group. But actually, that without all that social wraparound, you were more likely to complete the course of study on OpenLearn, which was really intriguing. Why is that the case? Lots of different theories put forward for that, but no pressure, I think. It was the lack of pressure. Mm-hmm. And if you put enough formative assessment into an open, unsupported course, it seemed to be satisfying enough to a learner to feel as if they were getting something back. What have I learnt? I can get feedback through this automated system. And actually, I don't want to talk to other people. And I don't want to submit a piece of work that my peers are going to review. I'm quite happily working on my own. So I think it was a style that suited people, perhaps those with less confidence possibly. But it was indeed intriguing to reveal those different, very different demographics, but also the different outcomes for those groups as well, working through the same material.
Yeah. So the students too would differ in motivation, wouldn't they? I'd imagine many of the students going through OpenLearn testing whether or not a university degree is for them. So there's quite a bit of pre-motivation to get through it. Would that also be a factor?
That would be a factor. And because the numbers are so large on OpenLearn, you can sort of say, yes, that's the case for, say, 15 to 30% of learners. But then you've got all the others that have no intention at all of becoming formal students because they could never afford to. And so their motivations are entirely different. And that group is our outreach group, essentially. That's the retired group who are studying for the joy of it and wanting to keep themselves educated and moving. But really, it's that area of people that don't have English as a first language. It's those learners who need something to show their boss, to say, I've done this extra thing, could never afford to study. So there's definitely that outreach group. And then, of course, there's that group that suddenly have the light bulb moment of thinking, crikey, this is HE level. I can do this. This is fabulous. Show me the way. And off they go. And the better designed that course is, not surprisingly, the more enticing it is to become a student at a distance. But I think the thing we found was that it was that rich media formative assessment element that really pushed people through. But the minute you put anything in there that was remotely social, they left in droves.
That's really interesting. Petrina, you've got a long history of publication, at least the last, 10 plus years. There's been articles written about badges, other elements of open education. What are some of the themes that have come from your work that you think are still very relevant for people today?
Yes, badging, digital badging is a new phenomenon. It's often referred to more generally in the sort of grander scheme as micro-credentials. Badging was introduced, roughly speaking, about 2012, and it was because that badging had been introduced in online gaming, and it was a sort of social display of your prowess in a game. I've earned this badge in this game and I can show my fellow gamers that I've got these achievements, and that's all great. And everyone's familiar with the concept of a badge, right, from Scouts and Girl Guides and all the rest of it. You grow up with your gymnastics badge and swimming badges. So it's an easy concept to grasp. And then people started blogging about what would be the relevance to that for education. Could that be a motivational tool potentially? And the Mozilla Foundation issued some grants early on and a competition back in 2012 to ask people working in education, how might you pilot digital badges in an educational setting? And there are a range of people that completed this piece, and within 6 months, there were about 100 different organisations and small charities issuing badges. So it was an interesting thing. A lot of, again, similar to the OER movement sort of 5 years, 6 years previous to that, there was a lot of theories about how it could possibly work for education. And the Open University and my team, we looked at those risks to us and thought, what would those risks be to the brand if we brought digital badging into the OpenLearn platform? Because is there an opportunity to motivate people to get a digital badge for their learning? And indeed, our own students, what would that mean? And the work for me, I feel, it shows that there's a real role for digital badging in open educational resources. Because where we've identified that group that don't necessarily want to become a full-time permanent student, a full-time formal student, there's still an opportunity to get something for their learning. So digital badges were introduced on OpenLearn around about that time, around about the 2012, 2013, as a pilot. And we put those digital badges on courses that were aimed at what we would call the access level for higher education, so basic skills learners, basic maths, learning to learn. And saw to our complete amazement that the lure of the digital badge attracted an even more less well qualified, if that makes sense, that's not an oxymoron, an even less greater group, anyway, less well qualified people than OpenLearn as a whole. So it was really intriguing to see that it had the badge on its own, irrespective of the subject matter, was there it was saying, come on, you really want to get this digital badge. And indeed, for one of those courses, 40% of the learners were declaring a disability. So it had a real meaning. And in those early days, there were surveys that I issued at the start of those courses and at the end of those courses. Learners really wanted the digital badge, weren't quite sure why, really wanted to get it, felt it was an achievement. It had the OU logo on it. It was a big deal. It's this thing from the Open University that I haven't had to pay for. Wow.
Yeah.
And at the end, what have you done with your digital badge? Well, I don't really know what I've done with my digital badge. I've got it. I've printed it out and it's on a piece of paper. It's with my certificate. So it's not traveled digitally yet. So those early days were very much about the idea of how motivation could be enhanced by the lure of a digital badge. And I think things have moved on a lot since then. Digital badges really now have found a bit of a niche in employability, soft skills recognition, career development, that area. Mm. And indeed, that has reflected on the courses that we use digital badges for on OpenLearn now. It's very much a focus for the commissioning strategy is to reach people in that way. It's relevant to our students as well. A distance learner, for example, may have to wait more years than just the normal two or three to graduate, and a digital badge for something that's slightly sitting outside of the curriculum is of interest to them because they can show an employer without having to wait until they've graduated. And I think the world of micro-credentials is much further ahead in the United States. There are bigger projects, bigger issuers. It's more well understood as a career enhancing activity to associate digital badges with non-accredited learning. So yes, America leads the way in this regard. We're still quite far behind. But I know from looking now at people who want to obtain a digital badge from OpenLearn and in these start and end of course surveys, it's a slightly different landscape now. I do know I can put my digital badge on my LinkedIn profile. I do know that has a meaning to me. I showed my employer and it made a difference. And for our students, it's very much about saying, well, I might have the chemistry degree, but I understand about leadership and management because I've done my digital badge without having to fully dip my toe into the MBA. I've got these other things that can enhance my employability.
Brilliant. And in terms of formal education, formal qualifications, badges could supplement those with recognition of other soft skills, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. And for people in particular, with particular career aspirations, some of the co-branding activities that are being undertaken now will really enhance that. So at the moment, we're developing a digital badge with Rolls-Royce about risk assessment. We are co-branding with Google around soft skills, and the CPD Standards Office have co-branded a range of our employability and skills badged courses. So they're heavily assessed. You know, you can't just keep flunking the quizzes to get it right. You get thrown out of the system if you try, so you do need to have understood. But they are, again, open, untutored courses that you can finish in any amount of time and released in multiple formats.
Right, and all freely available through OpenLearn?
All freely available. And I do think, though, looking forward, that OER more generally is missing a bit of a trick with digital badges. I think there's a real home for them, and I think OpenLearn has shown that there's a real home for digital badges and open educational resources.
So, Petrina, what other research have you been up to over the last few years?
My research is mainly been about the business model for open educational resources, how that's grown. And I would say the key areas for that have been learning about what learners want from OER, and that has been recognition. So recognition for learning is a big thing for me. And obviously digital badges form part of that, but so do free certificates as well. So it may seem like a bit of a no-brainer now to think that I might get a certificate for some online learning, but it didn't actually exist in OER very much at all 5 or 6 years ago. So that was a big shift. It was the whole recognition for learning. And also those definitions that sit around informal, non-formal learning. What do they mean now? As an informal learner or a non-formal learner, am I doing this? Am I self-directed? Am I just coming across information? Or am I really setting myself up to learn something here? And I want to be recognised for that. I want to share that achievement. Those are very different from what we understood to be informal and non-formal learning sort of 10, 15 years ago. So technology has been a real influence on how we understand informal learning. So I've been discussing and researching those definitions, really, of how technology has impacted our understanding of non-formal learning. I've also had a look at what disabled learners particularly want from open educational resources. And so within that huge data set of people who are looking at the Open Learn platform in particular, that sort of 19 to 23% who are declaring a disability, I surveyed them further and said, well, what is it about OER that you need? Do you have any particular needs or what's lacking for you in this area? And actually, the motivations of people who were declaring a disability were very much the same as anybody else using open educational resources. They still had the same reasons for doing it, but actually their technical needs were very different. I don't want to study this thing online. The key thing for the disabled learners that identified on Open Learn was that they wanted their learning in multiple formats. And again, that might seem like a simple concept now, but at the time, online courses were ostensibly delivered through online platforms. There may be some flip learning happening, as we know, with particularly around the use of videos. But actually, the requirement was, I need this on a different kind of a device, thank you very much. Mm. And what was achieved with Open Learn was we were able to set up a system whereby we piggybacked onto the VLE that is able to issue, well, through a mechanism that's been devised at the Open University, multiple formats from the content that's made for modules, and deliver multiple formats for the open educational resources. And disabled learners in particular had declared they wanted Word and PDF, but we were also able to issue EPUB versions and Mobi versions. And what that led to was we were delivering the certificates. We then issued multiple formats for this particular group, went back to this particular group and said, how are we doing? We've just issued this. And really and truly, all across the piece, the disabled learner group were declaring the same likes and dislikes and motivations and issues as other learners on the platform. So I felt that we had really answered their need. It also opened up another opportunity, which was to publish for free on Amazon. So we took the opportunity to issue all of those ebooks onto Amazon for free, and there are over 900 of them there now as free OER, because what I knew from my research into YouTube, iTunes, and Open Learn was that they're very different audiences using the same OER across multiple platforms, ditto FutureLearn. So let's open up a new channel on Amazon to put all of these ebooks that we've created for our disabled learners.
So in that, it sounds as though the sorts of learning design being applied is basically text-based. So these modules can be printed. They don't necessarily include multimedia.
That's a very good question, because on Amazon for a very basic Kindle, you can't really have much multimedia at all. So files that are rich media might look great online, but are problematic when you're referring back to different file types. However, on iTunes with iBooks and on Google Play as well, in the more embellished EPUB format, you can bring in all of those features. So it's actually device dependent.
Right.
But we figured that giving something away for free was okay. We have all the caveats in the Kindle ebooks to say, look, sorry, but this is not available on this device, but you can go to the website and see it if you want. So some of the problematic courses in that area would be language learning, where there's a lot of files that you would need to listen to. But other areas are quite straightforward. If we can clear the rights for images, a lot of art history and other subjects do quite well.
Brilliant. So the print mechanism doesn't necessarily discourage you from using other multimedia, it just becomes a constraint for those students who use those types of device.
Yes, and we're not designing for multiple devices, we're designing for online, but we're just trying to improve the way that those multiple formats can work. I think in the future we might pay more attention to how these things work online, because at the moment they're automatically issued. I think we need to have a closer look at whether they really stand alone. I would say the majority of them do, but there's some that may not. But again, because you're issuing as free OER, it's not like you're dealing with a paying customer as such. We're just aware that we're able to reach a wider audience.
We'll certainly link to some of your work through the website as well. I think there'd be a lot of interest in those sorts of articles that you've been preparing. It's now the end of 2018. What are your observations about online learning at the present time? What are some of the key themes that arise for you?
If I could work in a purely research profession, if I could just sort of wave my wand at OpenLearn and then the whole great business endeavour would run itself every day, I would just be in heaven, because I could run as many research projects as I'd like to. I have a massive list of things I'd like to research and understand more about online learning, particularly with that OER lens, because I think that's my area of expertise now. And for me, this is in a couple of strands. It's about career progression, I think, as well. How do people use online learning for career progression? It's a bit vague. It's becoming a sort of ubiquitous entity that we can just look anything up, get some learning. We might pay for some of that, we might not. But really, how does that affect career progression? And do employers recognise something that you've undertaken in your own time as an online endeavour? And is there a particular design for career enhancing online learning? I don't know. What have employers thought about these sorts of things? What would they like to see from career enhancing online learning? So yes, that's my area, I think, that if I could, I would want to look at. Those are the things for me that OER is serving at the moment. Those are the areas that OER is serving. I would like to look more into that. Also, there's a real push, as I know, close to your heart, about digital learning as well, being purely digital. And also this sort of intriguing element of social learning. Is social learning something that perhaps we've peaked with a little bit perhaps now? And if we sort of, you know, push that to one side, that's a little bit more of an optional feature for our learning, for our learners. So what replaces that? How do we best deliver online to unsupported, untutored students? Because that would be the cheap business option. And I don't know the answer to that. And in fact, not being forced to interact, does that really work for certain subjects? Can you teach soft skills, leadership and management without any real kind of interaction? Does that really have an impact at the end of the day on how you are as a leader, or how you are as a team player, how you are as a communicator? And so those are the areas for me that I don't feel as if enough is known. I would love to research them. Yes, that's my ideal world situation.
Sounds like a few lifetimes could be invested in those questions. Just coming back to the relationship of OpenLearn, FutureLearn, the whole informal, formal qualification thing. I've always considered OpenLearn to be like the pre-stage of an Open University qualification in broad terms. FutureLearn almost positioned at the end of that for graduates. I know it's a rough and ready sort of way of looking at things. But does that resonate with you to some extent?
It does. And it's a useful way to describe the platforms, I think, from the perspective of working with other external agencies. But the reality of OpenLearn is that it has a vastly larger audience. And part of that is because all of the courses are open. They're not hidden. You don't need to log in. They're there for everyone to see, and they don't close. So our Google juice, if you like, is extremely strong. Also, OpenLearn has a lot of very well-respected referrers, so Google favours us for that reason. The site is secure, and it's well-liked as well. It's highly ranked. So all of those things bring in a lot of people to the site. So I think we've got a different kind of a channel in. I've got my phone, I'm on the bus, I'm having a conversation, I need to look something up. Are you sure? Is that what Plato really said? I'm just going to check that out. I Google it. And there I am. I'm inside a piece of a course. But as far as I'm concerned, it's just a web page. What's this thing I'm in? I'm in a course. Okay, what's this website about? I can watch a video on this. And suddenly there's a whole other set of resources available to you. And it's a whole other different business presentation to FutureLearn, which is set courses with set times. So I think the big reveal to someone coming in from an internet information search is that they're somewhere else altogether. Now, they may have got the information they needed and off they go, but they're different opportunities. And I think that's probably why the audience is bigger, coming in for a different set of reasons, not necessarily they've come in looking for learning. Now, there's also going to be a set of people that have Googled free maths course and off they go. And that's their mission. And they want to do a maths course. They want to help their grandchildren with their homework, or whatever it might be. So you're catching everybody with Open Learn, as opposed to having made a decision to go to a website, to do a course, to pay for a certificate. I think it's a different group. Now, there are about 50% or more learners on Open Learn that don't have a postgraduate or a graduate qualification.
Yeah.
And on FutureLearn, the number who do have that qualification, I believe, is around 80% at the moment. But that still leaves a roughly speaking, about 50% of people on OpenLearn who do have a graduate or postgraduate qualification. Yeah. And those physical numbers are larger than the FutureLearn numbers. But OpenLearn doesn't have the marketing machine. It doesn't have the budget. Its traffic and its success has really been built up on the fact that the courses are perpetually open. And because there are thousands and thousands of pages that the search engines can index if you lift open courses and you don't hide them behind a paywall. And, you know, that's one of the beauties of OER, is that it's just out there all the time.
I want to pick up on something that you mentioned, but you talked about Google Juice. That's the data that the Google search engine will pick up on to emphasise results. So OpenLearn ranks very highly on that.
It does. And also Google Juice is probably a bit of a colloquialism, but also I think for me it refers to search engine optimization as well. It's how well, because an academic could really, really brilliantly put across their subject matter, but they might provide a really awful title. And my job and my team's job is to sort of say to that person, do you think anyone's going to search for that? How might we might make that discoverable? And so Google Juice for me is also about sort of revealing content in the most topical way to Google, to try and think about how people are searching. Google Juice is also about paying for AdWords as well. You can pay for that top slot, and you know sometimes you can get almost a whole page of adverts before you get an organic response. But yes, Google Juice is many different things. But having .gov and other sort of high referrers or highly regarded referrers helps your ranking as well.
What I wanted to come back to is just a conversation between formal and informal learning. It seems that the boundaries are becoming a lot more blurry as we progress through the years, as online education disrupts things. I'm really interested in your perspective on where the future might lead to that, or for that.
I think there's much more we could do. I can't influence the institution I'm working in to build that any more than it already has. It might have to do that more in the future, but there's lots of very savvy folks that I work with in the faculty, so we're already nudging at the boundaries of that relationship between informal and formal in terms of bundling up non-formal learning for credit. Some of those opportunities are wrapping up bundles of OER that have been badged, for example, have robust assessment on them, and then paying towards a qualification, but only having to pay for the exam or producing a portfolio of work.
Right.
So that sort of boundary for me is very tangible, not fuzzy, and we can see that it works quite well for certain subject areas. I think the more ambitious thinkers would say you could just reveal vast amounts of your curriculum, actually, much more cheaply for free, and then just pay for the exam at the end of it. I thought that was going to move more quickly than it has over the last 5 years. And it hasn't, as far as I can see. But I think what is opening up is an area that's in between non-formal learning and a formal degree. There's a different space that has some kind of an appeal and some recognition. And again, I think it's what do employers think of that? How many big employers are still in the mode of, well, we need a degree? Well, what are those other kinds of building blocks that sit between the non-formal and the higher education qualification that can still be issued by higher education institutions that have some merit but don't have that full level of commitment of a degree?
Yeah, so it almost lends itself to different sizes of badge to some extent. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Petrina, obviously you've benefited from the perspectives of others. You can't get very far in online education without having some names that you'd like to drop. So who would you recommend as leaders or legends of online learning? People whose work has significantly influenced you, or who you think otherwise have some sort of really important perspective worth sharing?
There's three people I wanted to mention. One of them is Shai Rasheff. And Shai Rasheff is the founder of the University of the People, based in the United States. And the degrees from the University of the People are built on other people's open educational resources, and then you pay to take an exam. And those subject areas that are offered by the University of the People are only, it's a very small curriculum, but it's only really around the skills that are needed in the workforce, the skills that we lack, the things that the country, the US, really needs. I believe that's business and there's healthcare in there as well. I haven't checked for a while, but I think that's where what they were doing. Yeah. And Shai Rasheff waives all fees for refugees. So he's a bit of a leading light for me in terms of what you can do with open educational resources and how you can take that equitability even further. So there's him. The other person I'd really like to mention is Wayne McIntosh. I take my hat off to Wayne McIntosh for his work with the OERU.
Yes.
And how he has absolutely doggedly delivered that concept. He has got credit now and validation for the degree and the modules that are being offered. I think Wayne, for perseverance and belief in OER, the OER that's not delivered via textbooks, so he's still going for this online taught endeavour using OER, of which the Open University proudly contributes to. And as not-for-profit, I think definitely Wayne. The last person I'd like to mention is Josie Fraser, who is on the Board of Trustees for Wikimedia and who now works for the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. She's a great thinker, consultant in online learning and open learning, and I've heard her speak at conferences. And she's so passionate about what she thinks about the Creative Commons, if you like, and has influenced me sort of at a distance, really, as someone who I enjoy listening to, always has new ideas. And he's very good at getting you all on board, I feel. But as someone who on the Board of Trustees for Wikimedia has a great deal of knowledge and understanding of what openness really means. And for me, that connection with online learning is really key in my work.
Brilliant. Thank you, Petrina. I've learned a lot from this conversation with you. I always do when we talk. You are indeed a leader of online education. Thank you very much for spending time with me this afternoon.
Thank you for asking.
You can find Petrina's profile and links to her research from our website. Her Twitter handle is HigherEdPetrina. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.